to keep me busy, who could appreciate my concept and how I want to practice. And that was very true. It had an identification and patient relationship that had a strong measure of value to it. Also, the retention factor. Although I'm reasonably knowledgeable of some of the motivations, the Democratic Administration Academy, I don't like to get into personal references in this interview, so I don't want this included. There's a distinct difference in salesmanship to sell a man a car he can't afford than there is to selling a patient a service he doesn't need. There's a difference in the integrity reference. Since the patient is ignorant of a professional service, well, he may not be ignorant of what he's viewing. His desire for something tangible, which could give him a sense of well-being, although it may not be a wise expenditure of funds, has an entirely different dimension to me than having a patient go through an extensive dental procedure, which in essence produces more income with the dentist than there's value to the patient. And the patient in a sense is at the mercy, or you might even say at the discretion rather than mercy, of the dentist or the physician. And it's a troublesome relationship, a challenge in some ways to what I would say is temptation. Temptation for the dentist and sometimes temptation for the patient to accept a cosmetic alteration through economic means as a substitute for his needs. I don't say that there aren't areas for this that has a strong measure of value, but I don't think that as a measure alone that it hasn't really been more abused in the broad sense than it has value as far as service to the individual. That's a condemnation. It's a very loose one and fraught with many porosities, but I feel that way, and I'm perfectly willing to make that statement.
What would you say the major changes or major advances have been in endodontics since you started practicing?
There have been several. One is, I think that the public, a segment of the public, or that segment of the public which seeks dental service, develop a strong sense of tooth retention prior to that of the profession, that part of what took place was a demand requirement. Regardless of all of the philosophical evaluations and projections, it is my personal opinion that Hollywood and television is the greatest motivation in dental service of any two things that has struck Western civilization.
What would you say?
And that's the cosmetic values of retention, overlooking the what we call a capping craze or whatever you want to call that. But the feeling of well-being that people have in retaining their own dentition, it's the maintenance of the youthful identification, the other factors involved in the desire to be among the more elite. The elite tend to keep their teeth better than the less privileged, and I think this also has an identification of emulating those that you look up to. There was another circumstance once, I think, that motivated me. I had a patient once right after the war, extremely overweight, worked for the federal project where they were selling off work surplus. Came to see me and just kept the lips almost tightly closed together, wouldn't show any of the dentition. She needed something done, and one of the men in her department, bosses, was a patient of mine, told her to come see me. And I looked at her. She had extensive fluorosis, discoloration at the back of stays. There's some endemic fluorosis now, broad geographically. I realized what an impairment this particular deficiency had to her sense of well-being. And I started then to do some work in this particular area, and there wasn't much in literature. Everything from acid, buffing off the surface of the enamel. Somebody in Arizona was doing that. Some work was done up in the Midwest. And we live, or rather I live, in the center of the textile industry of the world, in which there are many, many people with very sophisticated backgrounds in chemistry, physics, working textile industry that I knew and could have some communication with. And we started evolving a technique where we could remove most fluoro stains, even those that are almost tobacco brown, in roughly 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes. I saw this particular woman 27 times and got the teeth at a point that she would smile. Just completely changed her personality with what I was a very simple area, very simple procedure, very simple problem. I mean, she could have solved her problem maybe with capping, but capping wasn't that prevalent in those days with porcelain jackets. Then I went, you know, driving through the countryside. It wasn't like driving on the expressways today. You'd stop at a filling station with gas, maybe drink a Coca-Cola, stop maybe and get a sandwich, and some little girl would come up to wait on you, 17, 18, 19 years old, and you could see she had popcorn across the front of her mouth. She was raised in a rural area, had fluorosis, and the cosmetic values were already fairly significant directly after the war. All the teeth out, and you can see this a little flipper or partial with wrought clasps holding in these six teeth in the front from cuspid to cuspid. It was grotesque to me, bothered me. And I think maybe this is part of what we're talking about, the evolution of retaining the natural dentition, more than it was the biological aspects or the other aspects. I had one patient moved me in a way to realize and appreciate just how much significance that particular situation would be to one person. And I had a friend who had a diastema, 9 millimeters. Her two centrals, companion centrals and sinuses, were also 9 millimeters. So it looked like she had one full tooth out right in the median area. Freedom was very heavy, bright young lady, Phi Beta Kappa, Duke University, at 18 years of age, known to all Malai. And I started playing around with that particular situation and were able to provide a symmetrical closure of that. All an extensive job. I charged her $500, and my lab bills are $482. It wasn't, you know, I was afraid to get involved with the emotional problems of sensitive vein women. She was a very sensitive vein woman, bright and capable, but no less vain. And I saw, too, how her personality changed. She never smiled without putting a hand in front of her mouth or a handkerchief, or turning her tongue up over her teeth. Little things which I would be identified with as a dentist and would pick up very quickly, where other people would consider just an idiosyncrasy on a part of the individual. So maybe in a way, these little situations touched me, and maybe you get a little stronger motivation maybe about what some teeth mean to some people.
Let me get a little bit into the involvement, your involvement into the AAE. You were the founder and founder of the Endowment Memorial Fund.
Yeah.
Foundation.
Yeah.
Could you get into the original purposes, how it came about, the need for it, how
sure
you conceived it, things of that nature?
At a meeting we had in Florida, I'm guessing 62. I may miss the year. Get back to the past, present, and say, I don't remember the years. What page was that on?
I don't know. I have a few in here.
Well, it's in here somewhere. Don't they list the past, presents on one of the pages? Identify years better that way.
Is this after you were president?
No. Oh, no, long before. Oh, there was a page in there. I saw it a minute ago. You gave me the Clyde Davis date. Where did you get that from?
I got that right out of this book.
What year was Vince Miles president?
Okay. Vince Miles
62. Okay. When Vince Miles was president, we met in Florida. It was a big upsurge because of the weather problem in Chicago and the Conrad Hilton Hotel, and we felt we were pushed around there with the meeting in conjunction with the Chicago Midwinter meeting. It was hard to get there because of weather. It was hard to get out because of weather. Rooms weren't ready, and it was a move one year. It got so bad to get the devil out of Chicago and go to some place where the climate was better, not realizing that in order to get to the climate better area, you had to leave the area where climate was bad, and you had to fly back to the area where climate was bad. Sometimes the hotel rooms weren't available because people couldn't leave, and conversely. So it really was, was no panacea. And created, I think, in a way, a movement that was expensive and not necessarily productive. But at that particular meeting, two things were interesting. One is it was hard to get the people in lecture rooms, although that particular year we had a fantastic program, probably the most sophisticated program we'd had in a long time. Real headliners. I used to write the history of Dennis to the people that had on a program there. At that particular meeting, Alan Liban from New York, who was one of the earlier pioneers, and I used to love to read his book reviews for the ADA because he reviewed most of the anhedonic literature, at least if he didn't, I thought he did because I read his reviews. Very sweet, benevolent man who moved me when, in a way, when I first came to the first anhedonic meeting, very cold, people didn't pay attention to you. You got your badge, you walked in or walked out, and I was standing out in the foyer one day, one of his small rooms in the Conrad Hilton. This gentleman walked up to me and said, "My name is Alan Liban." And I told him who I was, and he was very personal, very warm, but about the only person he spoke to me. I had the feeling if I'd have dropped dead in the hallway, they'd have stepped over me, and maybe somebody would have thought to call the bell captain and move me. But there was a very austere indifference towards people. I don't know that it was intentional, but there was no question that it was there. I'd come up from the South. I'd been on the damn train 26 hours to go from Charlotte, North Carolina, to Chicago. 26 dull hours, and the train was usually never on time. And even in the early years when I used to fly, I think in a span of 10 or 12 years, I made a trip round trip once without spending the night in Cleveland or spending the night in Atlanta. The plane couldn't move or get fogged in or couldn't land, couldn't get out of Chicago, couldn't get in. You take a minimum of 4 or 5 hours on a flight, which used to stop in Indianapolis, Louisville, Charleston, West Virginia. So it was almost a challenge to go to a meeting by air or by train, disregarding the economic involvement. Plus the unattractive cold weather, which some of us were not too used to. But get back to the point of reference. In Florida, Alan Liban became ill and died. I had a personal feeling about him, maybe a sense of gratitude, you might say, as a man who had befriended me, who certainly was a figure in anhedonics. And I didn't know if he was married, didn't know if he had any children, didn't even know where he lived, didn't know how to respond in some way to satisfy my own response to the fact that someone who had a regarding respect had passed away. What could I do? I went to Dr. Myler and said, yes, we ought to have some mechanism for the organization to express itself, because there are a lot of people who in that time, who at that time were reasonably older people. We had a number of them, the founders. Take a look at the founders, 1978, damn few living. We lost a lot of them, and I think part of the tragedy of the organization is they have been forgotten, and no effort has been made to identify them. Because in a great sense, these were the pioneers who fought the focal infection, who didn't do the things that were popular, who fought what was unpopular. They were condemned, they were ridiculed, they were vilified, and yet they stood up and maintained and held the line and really built a house that so many of us live in today very comfortably. So I think we have an obligation, in a sense, to identify those who have contributed. What they got as flack, I think we are reaping in today as gold. And I think maybe we owe something to them, and I think not to remember that is a flaw. I don't think Dr. Malas either understood what I was trying to say or agreed. And I don't say this in any sense in a criticism. I would also like for this to be deleted out. because it would imply a disparagement or lack of response on his part. And I'm not sure that my communication levels with Vince at that time was such that he would necessarily respond favorably to me. The following year, Elmer Jasper died in Chicago on the podium. I knew the following year. I think that's the year Vince came in that year, and then Vince went out of office in Chicago at the Pitt Congress Hotel. That's what it was. I forgot who was president before Vince. I'm trying to think. Myles. Yeah, Hooky Brooks. I think Brooks was president at the Florida meeting. Then he went out of office, and Vince came in, inducted, and then he was president really subsequent to that. And maybe Vince didn't feel that he had the authority or the responsibility to initiate in that. Elmer Jasper died in Chicago on a podium, and his death created more of an emotional response because he died while he was actually in performance. There was a chap standing near me, he was a good friend, who says to me, I'd give $1,000 to perpetuate his name. He was the best friend in dentistry I ever had. And I said, I'm going to see that you get that opportunity. And then I started. One of the problems we had, mind you, this is already in 63, we had a problem with the board. We had a problem with education. We had no economic resources. I was chairman of the nominating committee. I was chairman of the program committee when George Stewart in 58 was president. I had a budget of $375 to put on the annual meeting at the Conrad Hilton Hotel for the AAE. I was responsible for the printing, the expense of the printing of the program, which came out of my budget of $375. At that particular year, I brought Nigard Ospe and Corey Langland to the States for that meeting, paid them each $100. I happened to check out of the hotel with Ospe. His hotel bill was $99, so at least he had a dollar's profit for that particular program. But the funding of the AE at that time was inadequate. I think we paid something like $8 dues a year for the membership that we had. Most people worked for nothing. There was no fault with that. But there were no dollar resources for development. We got on the board. When the board started, we borrowed $1,000 from the AE. The time the board received its first income from the applicants, that spent out of pocket over $30,000, which there was no agreement for reimbursement, no agreement to be paid back. This is based on economy flight round trip transportation, a $25 a day per diem, and a telephone expense maximum, I think was $50, was all that was allowed or repaid even after we had the economic resources to reimburse the board. They attended meetings of the reference committee, the ADA meetings, the other meetings of the council. That in computing this particular issue within the frame of reference of the board, and I still have that file, there was over $30,000 spent by these people before they ever got reimbursed. When we first put on the workshop on education, undergraduate education, we had no money. We had no budget as far as AE was concerned. There were no reserve funds. The board had no funds, had no way to get any funds until 1965, when they had the first board examination. The board was initiated in 1954. So to me, the foundation, when it was initiated, had two factors for me. One is it became an instrument for identification for those who had earned that recognition within the foundation, because it became the AE Endowment and Memorial Foundation. And then it became a resource for utilization of funds to do those things that had to be done in endodontics as a measure of its own resources for growth and development. We couldn't put on workshops, we couldn't have seminars, we couldn't have conferences, we couldn't have communication. We had no resources to bring in outstanding clinicians or to underwrite or support special type projects. We had no funds for student loans. We had no funds for graduate education. We had no funds for clinical development. And we went out initially to those who had achieved endodontic diplomate status, where I felt that a great deal had been done by few to bring to this broad area of dentistry a real measure of satisfaction and achievement. We didn't ask for anything directly, but two letters were sent out, that I sent out, asking no more than would they share in the development of the foundation, and asked that each diplomate make a pledge of $1,000 over a period of 5 years. We got in pledges, I think, from those two letters, maybe more than $50,000-$60,000. We never went to a direct solicitation of membership or to an arm-twisting situation for the procurement of funds for two reasons. It would have been an unkindness in some ways to put the dollar gift to the foundation to so many people who were in limited economic resources. You must understand there were people who were in education, who were living on a very nominal income based on what they'd achieved as far as salary in a full-time teaching capacity. And we didn't want to put them in an awkward situation compared to some of the younger men who were doing extremely well economically. And we never published the givers as far as whether or not they gave $100 or $1,000 or more. But that's how the foundation got started. I was the initiator of the maybe sort of fell to me because I sort of pushed it upon. I saw the economic needs from my own reference as having been program chairman. And I was president in 1965. And I think we started the foundation after that. I was trying to put on a workshop in Michigan. I put on one at Advanced Education at Forsyth. We had no money. And not just money to bring in expertise in other disciplines, but to bring even people from faculty. Well, the schools had no economic resources, and we needed these people in to share with and to really build what we were trying to build then was competence in the area of advanced education. We got some help almost the last minute from the American Fund. We got some other gifts. We had one dental manufacturer gave us a rather handsome gift anonymously, which provided us an opportunity to move the meeting to Boston. Otherwise, I don't know what we would have done. Although we had initiated and generated, I don't know if we'd ever brought to fruition if we hadn't gotten that benevolence from that source. But then money started coming in. Most of the money that has really generated by the foundation been generated by the activities of the foundation, continuing education. The basic membership did not give much after the initial request for support. There's been very little direct giving. With a personal, I think I'm probably the largest single contributor to the foundation. I'm not saying this with any sense of aggrandizement. It just happened that I was in position to do this. I also developed an item which was annual royalties. I gave the foundation yesterday a check for $863 from Columbus Dental just on royalties, an item that I facilitated where the royalties went to the foundation. So that's part of the resources of the growth. I don't think I particularly should have mentioned my personal reference in any of these things, instead, because I think it'll destroy what you're trying to accomplish. In trying to tell the story, I must use the personal reference. By the same token, I don't want it necessarily, I don't mind the editorializing it in a general vein, but I just do not have the personal reference. If it's complimentary to someone else, you can leave it in. But if it has any question of criticism, I would just assume you make a generalization rather than a definitive name statement. Okay?
Okay, very good.
It's 5 minutes after six. I've got a 6 o'clock appointment.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much. I appreciated your contributing to this. I could sit and listen to you for God knows how much longer.
Stories of the board are fascinating.
Hmm?
Unbelievable. Is that cut off?
No, still going.
Cut it off.
Okay.